Welcome to What in God's Name? I'm Chris Owen. My co-host Shana Appel is not able to be with us today, and I am sad about that. We're doing current events in culture from the perspective of philosophy and theology. Today's show is an interview that What in God's Name conducted with Dan Andrus. Dan is the fire chief for our capital city here in New Hampshire. He is our Concord, New Hampshire fire chief. One of the reasons I'm missing Shana so much today is this conversation that we have with Dan Andrus is so full. It's so rich with topics that lend itself to theological and philosophical reflection. The first 5 minutes of the interview gives you some biographical context for who Dan is and how he arrived to Concord, New Hampshire. The middle 10 minutes of our interview with Dan explores the opioid crisis. Dan has had a unique perspective on the unfolding of that crisis, and I ask him about his observations. And then the last 5 minutes of our interview with Dan, we pivot to post-traumatic stress disorder in firefighters and first responders in general. And Dan shares stories of colleagues. Many of them are stories of hope and transformation. There's some tough stuff in there. Dan is revealing of himself with regards to the things that he has seen. And he talks about suicide, life and death questions. So if my buddy Shana were here, the two things I would love to talk with her about in relation to our interview with Dan, the two things I would love to talk with Shana about are hope and transformation. Hope and transformation. Two key ideas, two key concepts in Christian theology. For all of our pagan friends and for all of us Christians who embrace our pagan roots, hope and transformation are all around us in nature right now. Here in the Northern Hemisphere, it is springtime. So all we have to do is open our eyes and look out the window to see hope and transformation right in front of us. So I invite you to think about, as you listen to Dan, think about hope and transformation and look outside your window. Let's listen now to our interview with Dan Andrus. Dan is fantastic. Joining us in conversation today is Dan Andrus. Dan is the fire chief in Concord, New Hampshire, in our capital city. Dan, it's so good to have you with us.
Chris, it's great to be here in this great place and with you.
So I have a couple of questions for you just to help our listeners get some context. How long have you been the fire chief in Concord?
This June, it will be 11 years. We came here in June of 2008.
June of 2008. And where were you before then?
I was in Salt Lake City my entire life. I am a descendant of Mormon pioneers, and I had worked for Salt Lake City Fire Department for 29 years. I was the deputy chief for administration, and I had the chance to come here to New Hampshire. And my wife is a New Englander, and we had talked for, at that point, 20 years about someday moving back to New England for her and to New England for me, and someday came for us.
One of the things I'm interested in asking you about, from the Christian point of view, in terms of our work, we talk about vocation.
Yes.
So the idea there is that we have certain gifts that we have been given by God, and God calls us to share those gifts into the world. And so we hope in our life that the work that we do is, in some sense, an answer to this calling.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious about you with regards to a sense of vocation. Is being a firefighter, being the fire chief, does that fulfill a calling for you?
Being a firefighter, an EMT and paramedic, certainly. Being fire chief, some days yes, some days no. It was always, I loved the period of my life when I was working 24-hour shifts, when I was on an engine company, when we were responding 10, 12, 15 times a day, usually to medical emergencies. And I never had the slightest doubt that I was doing God's work in that. When you are there and you're with somebody who's in a medical crisis and you're doing something, whether it's giving medications or running an EKG or just taking care of people, for me, it's the most fundamental kind of ministry.
Yeah, I was thinking about your work as the chief and thinking, yeah, there's probably parts about that work that's administrative and maybe not so, I mean, it's part of the job,
yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, you got to do it. And good administration can be a calling as well as anything else. But I was wondering about that part.
It was clear to me, it was about 11 years ago, I had the chance to step up in Salt Lake City from the role of battalion chief, where I was doing shift work, to a deputy chief rank. And I remember having some qualms about that, thinking, I really enjoy my schedule. I enjoy what I do. And there was this absolutely clear message, this clarity for me about it's time. It's time to step away from your work at the fire station and to go to an office and to work for systemic change and to work on programs. So I have, for the last 12 years, really enjoyed the multitude of things that we've done in Concord Fire, which has included the ways that we are expanding our outreach to people who are suffering from opioid use disorder. We had started an Explorer group. We also have a high school program, so we're involving young people, men and women, in thinking about careers and futures. And I think it's really, really neat to have young people who are engaged in thinking about a fire service career or an emergency medical career. I found so much satisfaction in my life. I would not have done anything differently. I don't regret a moment, any decision, any promotion, or the role I fill. And there are the days when I go home after 10 hours at work, and I've spent 8 of those hours working on spreadsheets, and, you know, you just go, gosh, I hope that was a day for the kingdom. You know, that was I'm not sure exactly how the kingdom moved forward there, but I guess something happened.
Right. Which,
and that's a true leap of faith.
Well, exactly. Because a lot of times we don't know the fruit of what we're doing, the seeds we're sowing, how will they sprout
exactly.
and bear fruit? We don't know. You mentioned the opioid crisis, and I wanted to ask you about that. You've been in your role for long enough time span to have seen that increase in addiction and addiction deaths
mm-hmm.
in New Hampshire. And I'm just curious what, as you think back on when that crisis was growing, what did you observe and how did things change for you?
Well, for years, we were responding on about 35 overdoses a year, my first 3 years here. And then all types of overdoses.
Yeah, okay.
And in mid-2013, one of the Concord police sergeants came to me and he said, have you noticed what's happening with overdoses? And I had not, but I started looking at the numbers. I went, wow, numbers have doubled for us. And thanks to Concord police, we started having conversations going, something is happening in the larger community and other communities that we are seeing a record increase in the number of overdoses. And the numbers continue to shoot up in 13, 14, 15. And finally, the last few years, more of a leveling off, but we were still at 6 times the number that we were doing just a few years ago.
So 6 times the number, say, from 2012-ish?
Yeah, well, actually, for 2017, that number was 293.
Yeah.
From 35.
Oh, man.
And that's just, I mean, that's just multiple times. And that 293 seems to have kind of leveled. And for 2018, it just went, it ticked down a little bit, but we've had a couple of years of tick down and then it jumps up again. So we're not confident that without some significant intervention and a change in the way of doing business, that we can keep that number down.
And to be clear, we're just talking about Concord, right?
We're just talking about the city of Concord, the capital city.
Yeah.
Manchester per capita, one time I did some research, has about 2.5 to 3 times the per capita level of overdoses that we do. In 2017, 14 Concord residents died from overdoses. That number went up to 17 last year. So while overdoses went down, fatalities went up. And I think about somebody who had substance use disorder in my family who died 15 years ago. And I think of another family that lost a son who was also a husband and father. And I multiply each one of those by 31, and I can't imagine the devastation that spreads through families. They don't seem like big numbers. But when you talk about individual cases and you look at them one at a time, this is devastating. These are kids growing up without parents and parents who have lost adult children. And the scale of human tragedy, even to that small number, is, to me, inconceivable.
Yeah. So just to be clear, you were talking about something around 290 overdoses per year. And out of that, deaths from overdose in the teens, right?
Yes.
14 or mm-hmm. so. Not a large number of deaths per overdose, but I mean, as an absolute number, I mean, you can slice the numbers that way, but behind every death is a tragedy and grief and ripples of pain.
Yeah.
So
it's just, you know, it's overwhelming to me when I think in our small community, we all know somebody whose life has been impacted by an overdose death now. There's somebody's cousin, somebody's neighbor, somebody's friend in Concord, somebody that you're in the Rotary Club with, someone who you see at the store, or someone from your church. It's just prevalent now. And if you go back beyond the 2 years before that, it's been, the number's been, you know, 10, 12, 13. And the last 5 or 6 years, it's 60, 70 people. That's a lot.
Right.
If we had had those people dying in fires, we would be really pulling in, or automobile accidents. We would have a major community conversation about how do we stop this? This is unacceptable. This is intolerable to lose this many people to this problem.
Yeah. So is the conversation, you're suggesting that maybe the conversation doesn't happen because of the way these people are dying? It's like, do you see avoidance? Like, are people in denial?
Somewhat. It's hard to, but on the other hand, in 2015, which was kind of the midpoint when this crisis was going on, I was at a Capital Area Public Health Network meeting. That is one of the agencies that Granite United Way sponsors, and they wanted to have a community event about Narcan use and about educating families. And they scheduled it for next week, and I said, you're out of your mind. You're looking at the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, and, you know, there's just no way that anybody's going to show up with 1 week's notice. And I went that night out of curiosity, but also to just kind of fill the tank a little bit. There are three conference rooms at Concord Hospital that used to open up into one big conference room. The place is packed.
Yeah.
The place is overflowing. It is just amazing to me how you say, we're going to offer something about overdoses, and people seem to come out of the woodwork who've been affected by this crisis. So they're out there, having them find a voice. It becomes a personal tragedy, and we have to move it from the area of a personal tragedy to the level of a community health issue, which is being done.
We need to take a quick break for this word as What in God's Name begins a funding campaign. Shayna, you know what? We've been live now for 4 months.
Oh my God, it's hard to believe it.
That's 15 shows, and it's a good moment to invite our listeners to a deeper level of support and engagement. So for a limited time, now through Easter, we are asking for your financial support. When you support What in God's Name, Shayna, you are supporting our core values, which are curiosity, depth, and
shine in the light.
Shine in the light.
Friends, here's how to make a donation. Go to our website at www.whatingods.com. WHATINGODS.com. Don't go to What in God's Name, because you'll come up with a bunch of cheesy videos and YouTubes. WhatingGods.com will take you to our website. Once you're there, you can link in to give either through Patreon. And if you need a tax deduction, link in through Filmmakers Collaborative. They're our fiscal sponsor. Let's make a difference for our culture, friends. And we thank you in advance for your support.
Thank you in advance for your generosity. And now back to our show. So in the conversations that you've had in the Concord area and in your own self-reflection, do you have thoughts about what is going on in the culture in our state? And obviously our state is not alone in this. Mm-hmm. About why now, and what, why?
Yes.
So I'm curious what you would say about that.
New Hampshire had at one point in the last couple of years, the second highest per capita overdose death rate in the country. I think last year we went to third, and I think this year we have gone to sixth. Not because we're getting better, but because other states are getting worse. It's a national problem. And as it's been framed to me by a couple of clinicians, we don't have so much a drug crisis as we do a mental health crisis in the country. The drug crisis is symptom. The mental health crisis is cause. There is a tremendous need for mental health services, and the level of mental health or mental illness is just epidemic at this point.
From a mental health point of view, is it depression?
Yes. Yeah. Depression, anxiety. They are not the really dramatic mental illnesses of schizophrenia and other very seriously impactful things. It's something that's so very common. But it's common. It's common in our profession, too. And we're looking inward. And we have the startling statistic that last year, across the United States, more firefighters died by suicide than died in the line of duty. which is a stunning statistic.
That is stunning. I want to follow up on that.
We'll talk more about that.
But let me stay with the opioids here for a second. Depression and anxiety. I'm not a mental health professional. That, however, seems to fit with how I see what's going on in the wider culture.
Yes.
There's a lot of, especially, I resonate, I wasn't expecting you to say anxiety, but you did. And that resonates so well with a lot of different things I read about increasing anxiety in our culture. And of course, my training is then to think of the theological and the spiritual health of people, which is related to emotional health and the breakdown of community, which is also, you know, I think if people feel isolated, then anxiety and depression can just seem really, really tremendously large, and you get into a sense of hopelessness about the future. People's stories are different. I can't pretend to say this is what happens for somebody who gets addicted to drugs or any other addiction for that matter. And yet, maybe there are some common threads.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I'm proud of my city for doing is joining in a class action lawsuit against pharmaceutical manufacturers who did so much to promote and push these opioids as pain relievers. And they're effective. There is no doubt they are effective. I had oral surgery about 3 years ago, and in my case, I bravely refused any kind of prescription medication because it was opioid-based. It was on a Friday, and that night my wife was driving to Rite Aid through a blizzard because I said, please fill this prescription. I'm in so much pain.
Yeah.
And she came back, and I went from probably a level 8 or 9 pain, which was just excruciating and unbearable. I couldn't think, I couldn't do anything else other than just hurt and hold my mouth. And I took one of those. And I had the most euphoric sensation. It was oxycodone. It was one of the typical ones.
Yeah.
I didn't care. I might have felt like there was still an unpleasant sensation, but I was absolutely in a place that was so blissful.
Yeah.
And it was good. And I went, oh, okay, this is why people get hooked on this stuff. That was Friday. I took one on Saturday. It gave me about half that effect. And I went, oh, okay, this is where it begins. And for a moment, I thought, well, if I take another one, I can get back there to where I was last night. And I thought, oh, buddy, you were in danger. I had 4 pills. So, oh, buddy, you were playing a dangerous game.
That's, you know, good for you because now what I imagine is because you've had that experience, you can walk in the other person's shoes who gets addicted. Like you can see, you had the experience of, I can see how this happens.
Oh, I can see where you can be so desperate that you would do anything to get back to that feeling from the pain of not having it.
Yeah. And the other interesting part about this for me is your story is about physical pain. Psychic pain is real too. People feel emotional pain. And the effect of these opioids is, again, it's the same effect, which is you get rid of the pain. And how attractive is that?
Mm-hmm.
Pretty attractive.
It's immense, and I have was going to introduce this in the conversation at some point. I have a friend named Mike Stevens in Salt Lake City. He's a captain at the airport station. Mike has gone very public with this, so I feel free to share it, and I share it with his encouragement. I've known Mike for 20 years. I met Mike when he came on the fire department. My wife knew his mother-in-law. We've known the family, and Mike and I have been friends for a long, long time, and I was stunned about 2 years ago to see Mike in a video talking about the day he came home. And he was so depressed and so anxious that he went to his bedroom, took out a pistol, and he said he had it pointed at his face, and he was looking at the bullet. And he said, I could see the bullet inside the chamber. And he said, I put it down. I was that close. He said, it was just a matter of a few seconds of putting my finger on the trigger and pulling the trigger on myself. I had no idea. I would have been completely devastated if Mike had taken his life, knowing his kids and his family and everybody else. And just, it really drove home for me how pervasive this is.
Mm. Thank you for sharing that story.
Yeah.
I guess I should follow up. How is he? I mean, so he's being very public with this.
Yes. Mike's story is that particular moment, he put the gun away. He called his doctor. He talked to the doctor. He was referred to a therapist who introduced him to EMDR therapy, eye movement and desensitization. Much of Mike's problem. Oh, that's interesting. When I talk about how Mike feels, go back to where I am too. In this profession, you see so much tragedy and so much heartbreak, and you see dead kids, and they never leave you. And those images can haunt you as they were Mike. And as Mike described it, he had insomnia. He couldn't sleep. He didn't want to sleep because he would fall asleep. He'd dream. And the bad things he saw happening, he saw the people he loved. He said that's what, and he said it would just become incredibly worse, like there were dozens of people dying this way. And Mike, through the EMDR therapy, was able to move past that and would tell you now he's in great shape. Still working in his recovery, still not fully healed, but a long, long way from the guy who was sitting pointing a gun at his face a few years ago.
Yeah. So he's sharing his story to be helpful to others.
Yes. There are some brave people like that. There is Mike in New Hampshire. We have a guy named Todd Donovan. Todd is a very highly respected firefighter paramedic for the town of Derry. And Todd has been public with his story that he made his first suicide attempt at age 8. And Todd found his way back in his late 40s through another technique, which is actually transmagnetic therapy or something. It's a completely different kind of approach to treating depression and anxiety, but there's treatment out there. It works. And several members of our profession are stepping forward so that our peers are telling us, you will probably be in this place. There is help. This is not the end of the world. This is not the edge of the cliff. You don't need to jump. You can find your way back. And you can only find your way back. You can find a very good place. I have a friend named Scott Geiselhart, who is from Frazee, Minnesota. I met Scott last fall. Scott actually went through with a suicide attempt. He put a gun to his head. He pulled the trigger, and the gun misfired. He said the gun had never misfired before. Had the gun not misfired, we would have never been talking about him. He would have been a statistic. But he talked about being so frightened by the fact that everybody probably thinks sometime about doing that. But he says, I know I did it. He said, it was the point where I pulled the trigger on myself. And Scott found his way into therapy, and Scott's presentation, which is incredibly moving, is seeing in color again. He said, when I was going through recovery, I started noticing the colors of life and trees, and he said, and the splendid palette of colors that are available for us to enjoy. And he said, now my life is once more seeing in color, and it's a life of joy. And what a story of transformation, but it's possible. It's possible to get there from literally the lowest point at which you can be, which is taking your own existence away from yourself and everybody else too.
I love that image or that metaphor. It's even literally and physically happening.
Yes.
Of being seeing color again. That just suggests to me coming back to life.
Yes.
It's.
Scott said it was a physical experience
physical,
for him, but the metaphor is how he describes the recovery from anxiety and depression. You don't have to live that way.
So circling back to the statistic that you cited, which is the number of firefighters, was this last year, did you say you were saying?
This was last year,
so
yes.
The number of firefighters who have died from suicide is greater than, or was greater for last year, than the number who died in the line of duty.
That is correct.
And is it really the undiagnosed, untreated trauma?
Yes. Yeah. 8 years ago this month, my former paramedic partner from the mid-1980s shot himself to death. I would like to tell you I never saw it coming, but even back in the 80s, I was seeing some things that told me that things were not well with him. He had been married 4 times, and even though he was a great guy and active and a tremendous mentor to me in the field of paramedicine, there was something about his life which wasn't right. As well as I knew him, I knew he would never be the type of person who would seek help. That just was not in his nature, and ultimately, that decision cost him his life. And it's been 8 years. I've had a number of other friends too. I had a very close friend who died the next year from suicide. And these are impactful. And I think about them, and I think about how unnecessary those deaths were and how unnecessary opioid deaths are now.
Dan is a beautiful soul, and I hope you will join us for part 2 of this interview next Thursday, April 11th. What in God's Name is curating reflective content on our Instagram page, What in God's, also on our Facebook page, What in God's Name. We also have a website, of course, whatingods.com, whatingods.com. We look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.